I've always been riddled with incredible self-doubt. So what I've just managed to learn to accept that that is part of the tapestry. And if I can put it into a little box and just have it there as part of who I am, it can actually be quite a good anchor so that I don't get too carried away, so that I don't become too reckless.
Welcome to Dauntless Creators. From speaking to the self-releasing artist to the head of A&R at Universal Music, I hope to give you a better idea, whether you're an artist or aspiring CEO, on how to navigate your way through this unpredictable yet exciting industry. See you on the other side. I'm your host, Nina Rebessa, and on today's show, I speak to Brian Message. Brian is a partner in Courtyard Management, Radiohead's management business, and co-founder of ATC, the management and live booking agency. Here, Brian works with Johnny Marr, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and PJ Harvey. Brian is a director and former chairman of the MMF, the largest artist management organization in the world. He's also an advisor to the artist body, the Featured Artist Coalition, and a founding partner of the Fanfare Alliance, an organization that is radically altering the event ticket market in the UK for the benefit of fans and artists. A surprising and honest conversation about recklessness, doubt, and doing things differently. Enjoy. So, Brian, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
So I wanted to kind of start, I mean, you come from an accounting background.
Very true.
And I always find it quite interesting when people kind of move from one industry to the next, because I feel like they bring with them all this other insight and knowledge that helps them look at the new industry in a bit of a different way.
Uh-huh.
So can you just talk about what was that moment when you decided to go away from accounting and more into the music industry?
Well, actually, my journey, I suppose, certainly in my 20s, was that I kind of wanted to have my own business. That was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, I suppose, care too much what it was going to be in. I tried and failed repeatedly, having got my accountancy qualification. And then I kind of almost gave up, and I was going to go and accept a job offer from McKinsey's at the management consultant firm. And as I was about to do that, I got a phone call from a guy who said that there was a strange job going at EMI Records. And would I be interested to have a look at it? So I looked at it and I looked at music and I saw that music was quite entrepreneurial versus McKinsey's, where I'd be doing strategic consultancy or something for British Airways or something like that. Well, that's how it looked like at that time. So I thought, okay, I'll plump and I'll go for music. And if I keep my radar up, I'm sure I'll find an opportunity. And so I was pretty motivated to find an opportunity. And within about 6 months, so this must be 1993. I was introduced to two guys, Chris Hufford and Bryce Edge, by the then CEO of EMI UK, who I was working for, Tony Wadsworth. And I met those two guys, and having had 6 months in the record business, I was sort of scratching my head about how, from my perspective, how the thing was put together. And not really wondering how this business was a sustainable business. And I met Chris and Bryce, and we went for lunch. And they were managers, and they'd been managing these couple of acts. And they had very much the same philosophy as me.
Which is?
It was primarily based around the fact that much of the, or all of the investment into talent, musical talent, pretty much came from record companies. And that record companies' business model was wrapped around one right, the recorded music right. Yes, there was the publishing right that most of the companies had a piece of as well. And it was kind of scratching ahead, well, what happens if that right got disintermediated? And where would that leave talent, and where would that leave the music industry? And I think the three of us sat there, I remember it really well, three of us sat there over lunch kind of discussing the same thing, and actually how quirky it was in respect of an industry structure, when the talent is so important. It's not just about copyrights, etc. And I left that meeting, I left that lunch just off Manchester Square in London, and thinking, right, those guys are the guys I want to be in business with. So I spent about 12 months convincing them that it was a good idea, that we became partners, and eventually they succumbed. Mm-hmm. And I left EMI and joined up with those guys. So that was quite a pivotal moment for me in terms of coming from my background and looking at industries and businesses and sort of scratching my head a little bit and going, okay, well, how can this be done better, or where will this take us? Unbeknown to me, of course, at that time, we all got consumed a little bit in the development and I was hanging onto the coattails of the Radiohead thing that sort of kicked off after that and became a hugely dominant part of all of our lives for a long, long time, and just to some degree still is. But yes, I personally have always, it's a bit like, you know, Nick Cave's business now and his wife's business, The Vampire's Wife, going into The Vampire's Wife and looking at how technology has disintermediated the fashion business, like it does every business, and how then you build a brand new business around that is what I personally quite like to do. So, and that's proving to be a lot of fun.
Again, so now you're getting into fashion.
It was never the plan, but that's how it seems to be turning out that way, yeah.
Yeah, because you seem to really just kind of follow the clues that kind of are given to you. But I wonder, so you said it took 12 months to convince them to get into business with you.
Yeah.
How did you eventually convince them, and how do you stick to that belief to actually...
Whenever people are going to become partners, and, you know, quite rightly so, they were sort of, you know, well, how are we going to make this work? And Chris and Bryce had been in a band together, they were very much from a musical background, I was more from a business background. And as I think their business developed to a point where it made some sense to have a business guy come on board, then that proved to be the moment. So, and you know, when you become partners with people, you kind of don't want to jump into bed too quickly. You know, you want to get to know each other. And that takes some time.
Right. Yeah. ATC has kind of really stood for, you know, kind of building a business around the artist.
Yeah.
Right. And you said it's for those people who want to take the hard road.
Yes.
Do you want to kind of expand on that and on the importance of why you think artists have to start a business and look at it like a business, like a startup?
Yeah, look, I suppose, you know, look, it's the music industry, when I got involved in it in the 90s and moving forward, it was built off, certainly the record business anyway, was built off upfront investment and to some degree still is built off, or a large chunk of it is built off the creation of hits. Established, sustained businesses in music, or talent businesses to my mind, aren't so necessarily driven by hits. They can be, and that is a perfectly good measure. It's a difficult one, and we've had terrible problems as a business managing hits by artists that we've worked with early on. So things like where we've worked with people like Kate Nash, Catfish and the Bottlemen, Rumour, where we've had some hits off first records, it's tended to have blown up in our faces. It's a very difficult process to go from effectively nothing to, you know, go to, you know, rising that quickly can be really difficult for everybody, for the artist, for the management, for everything. So hence we've always quite liked that idea of growing things incrementally, small developments, but continuing to have momentum that moves forward. Sometimes you'll move backwards, that's the nature of life. But if you can build layer by layer And do that outside of the craziness to some degree of hit records and hit songs, etc., then you can have a sustainable business. And we're lucky now to work with a bunch of people. Nick Cave is an example, PJ Harvey is another example, where you're building things differently. And I think what's interesting for me about today's business for artists and for talent and for management and managers is that you can do that. You can build sustainable businesses. You have to stay the long game. You have to stay with the hard road. You know, I look at someone for us like Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes, where we've been working with them for about 4 years, and the first record that we did, I think the guys made the record for under 10 grand and our marketing budget was 20 grand. And the second record, we spent a bit more on making the music, and the marketing budget ended up being over 100 grand. The live side of it has done well. They're a great live act. They have quite a number of interesting revenue streams. And we now are looking at the next third album cycle, for want of a better description. Hopefully one day it won't be an album cycle. It'll just be a continuation of music, playing, revenue generation, etc. And we're doing it incrementally and not trying to get ahead of ourselves. And you can do that now.
Yeah. And so what about artists kind of on their way up trying to, you know, build a career for themselves? What would you say to them? Because I think they're all looking for different income streams.
Yeah.
How do you find the right income stream for the artist? Or are there set ones that you guys always...
Yeah, no. Look, if the world that we tend to live in under this roof is obviously wrapped around music. So, and particularly living in a streaming world, it's a well-known fact nowadays that you need to continue to create music all the time and continue to put it out and continue to build up a body of work, not a series of albums. We still get locked into series of albums because there are many parts of our industry, like the live industry, which... it's still, to my mind, a little bit backward. And there's a lot of people... many people in the live business need to see an album in order to plan a tour, or, you know, they need an event. Right. And albums are less likely to be events nowadays, but people still rely on that album to plot live things around it. There's still way too many people in the live music food chain. If you think about it, from the artist to the management to the agent to the promoter to the primary secondary seller to the secondary secondary seller, everyone, there's so many snouts in the trough that it not only does it queer the economics to some degree, but it also muddies the creative, in my opinion. But anyway, the live side of things is definitely right for disintermediation, but where it's obviously very important is for us is that we like to work with great performers. Mm-hmm. Great performers obviously can develop lots of revenue streams off the back of those performances. But that, so it's the key things, great performances, continue to keep putting our work, collaborations we all love and is a big part of the world as well, and continuing patience, continuing to create, having a good team around you, both as a management and on talent, is all great. I think there's a number of us who are getting a little tired of the term or label management, but we still have yet to come up with something better.
What do you mean by that?
I suppose the concept of the manager is like an old 1960s, 70s construct. The reality of management today is much more akin to being business partner.
Great.
Here we have teams of people who are the manager.
Right. Okay.
It's not, you know, the management of Nick Cave is not me. Mm-hmm. It's now five of us, and five of us who work really hard and work together as a team. So it's funny, I always feel a little uncomfortable when people refer as Brian Message, Nick Cave manager, because it's not appropriate anymore. He has a management team, and we're pretty much, I would say, and I think he would agree, is that we are all business partners together. We are a cottage industry, for want of a well-used term, working together on the development of the business, you know.
Mm-hmm. And the collaboration thing seems to be quite important here, like one of the big values. And so do you also get the artists then really involved as well? Are they really involved on the business side of things?
I like it, you know, look, yeah. I'm really keen that all the artists that we work with have a full understanding of what they're doing, because this is their life and this is their business, and they need to have an understanding and see the ups and the downs of the whole thing. You know, what you don't want to have happen is when things go wrong, is they feel like they're uninformed. So really keen to keep people, certainly the talent, understanding and knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, on the financial front, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think it's a really empowering time for artists to be able to understand their business as well. You know.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. No, it's the whole world has changed dramatically since when I got into the game in the 1990s, and I think it's a great opportunity for people to develop those talents, and they can be as, you know, they can be a cellist teacher working in New York on a subscription model. Right the way through to, you know, touring live performing acts to whatever. There's the opportunities now are out there, and you can get to people, and the tools are there to be able to do that. It doesn't guarantee success, clearly, because you have to have a talent at it. But if you have a talent and you're patient and you're hard and you can work hard, mm-hmm. you've got a shot to build your game, you know.
So, I mean, you've mentioned Nick Cave quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading an article where you were saying how you both are fired up by new ideas.
Yes.
Right? And you love adventure. So, what is it about, you know, ditching the rule book that you love so much?
Inspiration. It's all about, for me, hunting inspiration, mm-hmm. you know. With a bunch of our acts, you know, PJ Harvey has just finished a whole bunch of activity and is having some time off now. It's about hunting the next inspiration. What's gonna get us going and get us out of bed in the morning and get us fired up and wanting to do some things. Nick is particularly great at that. He really, I think he really thrives on that. We're very similar in that respect, and that's the thing. You know, there's a lot of day to day, a lot of, I don't want to call it drudgery, but there's a lot of living that has to be done that's repetitive and all the rest. So peppering it with risk-taking and throwing the rule book out is incredible. You know, I think that's what was being a part of the Radiohead in Rainbows thing was immense. It was that the inspiration and the energy that came out of that is almost like cracking an atom in my life. Mm-hmm. So having experienced that and been a part of that, I'm always just on the hunt for the next bit of inspiration, the next thing that's going to do things differently. I remember when Nick and I were sitting chatting about the concept of doing something different and not being an artist signed to a record company, but going to do a label services thing. And we wanted to do it with this company, Cobalt, who at the time had about four people, I think, mm-hmm. in their label services division. I think Nick and I were sort of inspired by the change of it rather than whether or not it was going to be a good job or not. Now, we all thought that if everyone pulled together, because everyone's desperate to make this work, that it would work. And it did work. It helps that Nick and his band wrote a great record, Push the Sky Away, so that helps you get through most things. But I think that inspiration it makes it very interesting. Which is why working with Nick and his wife on The Vampire's Wife is interesting again, because it's, you know, we were going into the fashion thing and going, right, there is a rule here that you tend to work in seasons, and there's a rule here that you tend to supply stock, wholesale, etc. Well, let's not do seasons. Let's let's look at how Supreme and Palace do things, and let's do things differently again. Mm-hmm. And I think the inspiring bit about doing things differently, you know, keeps the fires burning.
Yeah, keeps it interesting.
Keeps it interesting. Can sometimes be a little, you know, dangerous, because there's a difference between taking a risk and being reckless.
Yeah.
I have often gone, you know, you learn from experience a bit, but you can be reckless. I'm trying to be less reckless and more risk-taking, you know.
In what way, though, has being reckless kind of taught you lessons?
Well, I said the main one is that actually the main one is and someone quoted this to me a while ago, which is that it's a bit of a dull line, but it stuck with me, is that hope is not a strategy. Hmm. So I worked with an artist 10 years ago and threw £400,000 at it in the hope that it was going to work.
Right.
It didn't work. Hmm. And it struck me that actually what was driving me in that scenario was the hope. It wasn't a well thought out plan. Hmm. It was a hit in the hope. So that, I would say, of all things, that's been... That recklessness has helped me evolve into being more of a risk taker than just a hope merchant.
Mm-hmm. So you do always, you know, you love new ideas and trying things differently. Surely that comes with its fair amount of doubt.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with those moments of doubt and questioning if actually what you're doing is going to be the right thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's the because there's always the doubt and there's always the fear, and particularly interestingly, as things become more successful, you can feel it creep in. You know, with Nick and his career, it's going really well, and it's sort of growing in a really great way, and a very tasteful way. It feels like. And it's interesting, actually, because you can feel the fear or defensiveness creeping in, because you don't want to lose that. What's great? It's all great when you've got everything to play for. You know, where there's nothing at risk, almost, where you can take some risks. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, you start to get things moving into a bigger space where you've got this success and you've got something. You don't want to lose it. So you can feel that fear, you know, sort of just sitting on your shoulder somewhere. But in terms of answering the question, is I think you, what I've done is that I've always been riddled with incredible self-doubt. So what I've just managed to learn to accept that is part of the tapestry, and if I can put it into a little box and just have it there as part of who I am, it can actually be quite a good anchor so that I don't get too carried away, so that I don't become too reckless, and that actually I can manage things across a spectrum of feelings as to how this should be. So, you know, for many years I would say it was that fear and all the rest was a very dominant emotion for me, but it was sort of countered by this, I suppose, almost desperate need to continue to hunt and be inspired.
Yeah.
And now as I've got older, and when I'm 52 years old, and eventually I've finally got to that point where I can balance mm-hmm. all of those things, but it's taken an enormous amount of effort and work to get to that point where the fear isn't too pervasive.
It's funny how it takes a while.
Yeah, it is. What's interesting about it, of course, is that, you know, I did a talk actually once for an advertising agency board of directors, and they wanted to talk about my journey. And it's a very often used thing, but I sort of said that to some degree my journey through my 20s, 30s, and 40s was a series of failures punctured by some successes. Mm. But I managed to survive the failures. What's interesting about the failures, of course, is it feeds the fear. So it's not a particularly comfortable place to live in when you're continually being reminded that you can't do something, and then something happens that leaps you into something, into it forward, and then you suddenly get this imposter syndrome thing. Was, well, hang on, I've been failing, so which has confirmed the fear that I can't do stuff. Then something has compelled me up into this other space where really I shouldn't belong. Over the years working through that and understanding that, and that's actually pretty much what happens to most people, mm-hmm. and that you're not just on your own doing that stuff, has been interesting. So having passed 50 for the first time, I feel like I've grown up a little bit.
Finally managed that.
Yeah, the fear is interesting though.
I think a lot of people, you know, are either going to be driven by it or they're going to kind of hide because of it. So do you have a method, or do you have something that you turn to in those moments of doubt and fear that kind of help ground you and put things into perspective?
I'm experienced enough now to be able to sit back and take a view, so a focus, an understanding of what's going on, and not getting sucked into the drama of a moment or where something's going wrong. You know, rather than going down that plug hole, as you step back from it and see it in a broader context, that's really great. I'm a big lover of going to bed, sleeping, and getting up the following morning, and a new morning is a new day, and it can be really useful. I rely on that one a lot, because the perspective at the beginning of a day after a good sleep can be much better than after a crazy day of roller coaster stuff.
Yeah,
I'd say those. A focus on it, and then make sure I get to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the end of the day, you're going to be in bed.
Right? Exactly,
it's
absolutely.
Positive.
Yeah, exactly. I think as well, the standing back thing is important, because, you know, for all of us a lot who work in it, this is a luxury. You know, this is a first world thing going on, messing around in music and fashion and fun, and I'm not fighting for life or food or conflict or that kind of stuff. So I'm always cognizant that this is a privilege. Mm-hmm. So no matter how sticky it gets, it's a privilege.
Yeah. So what's the best piece of advice you ever received? You know, what would you tell aspiring managers or, you know, artists? What would you offer them as a
patience. Mm-hmm. It's not a race. Mm-hmm. Particularly for kids coming out, including my own kids who have no interest in music, but, you know, be patient, keep that radar up, keep looking, keep learning, keep making mistakes, learn from the mistakes. What you've got to do is you've got to learn from them. You can't just blunder on. Don't let your ego get in the way too much. Use the ego in the right way. But certainly patience is a big one. As I said, you know, look, I feel I'm just about starting to get into my stride now. I know it's taken me a long time. When I'm in my 50s, I wouldn't suggest that to anybody else, of course. It's a long time. But I think, patience. And don't be put off by things that go wrong. And you just got to keep with that. I think it's an interesting challenge for lots of kids who are now coming out in their early 20s, well educated, they know the world, they've seen it, etc., and they're and trying to find their way in it. There's lots of opportunities out there, but you've got to be patient.
It's almost like there's too many opportunities sometimes. You don't have time to choose.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, the remarkable thing about for all of us in the Western world is the extraordinary amount of choice that there is on every front possible, and it's not to drown in that choice. It's about being able to be picking the right opportunities, mm-hmm. being patient, failing some of those, moving on, but, you know, and just stay the course.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Hey, really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you learned something from it, why not share it with a friend who'd also really appreciate the knowledge? I'd also love to hear your thoughts and your feedback and any questions you may have, so feel free to tweet me at Nina Rubessa. I'm also always looking for collaborators and new guests, so if you think you can help, head over to bedauntless.co.uk and send me an email. Till next time.